Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hey guys, Jesse Green here, the Savvy Dentist Podcast, the show where great dentistry meets great business. And today, I'm thoroughly delighted to be having a conversation with Glenn Carlson, who many of you will know has been on our show before. Glenn is one of the co-founders of Dent Global, who are known for their Key Person of Influence program. And the thing I love about Glenn is he's got an incredibly incisive mind. It is razor sharp, and he has an ability to cut through the noise and get straight to the heart of the matter. So in this particular conversation, we cover an enormous breadth of territory. And what I particularly love in this conversation is Glenn's ability to distill the information to simple, practical, actionable steps that make an incredible difference if you apply them. So we talk a lot about building a lifestyle business, crossing the desert, building a performance-based business, building assets in your business because every headache, bottleneck, or frustration is due to an insufficiency of assets. And we talk about that in detail. But as I said, what Glenn's real knack is, in my view, is being able to distill a whole lot of information into clear, practical, actionable steps. So I know that you're going to want to take some notes on this, and I know you're going to want to take action on those notes. Just a little word of warning, Glenn asked me before the show what was our language meter, and I said, just be yourself. So there is some expletives in this particular episode. There's a few F-bombs, and you know what? If that's the sort of language that's going to offend you, please do not tune in to this particular episode because I didn't want to edit it out because it's Glenn being Glenn at his best. And there's so many wonderful insights that I hope you can get through that and take the message out of the podcast because it is absolute G-O-L-D gold. And as I said, you're going to want to take some notes on it. On a different note, we have our Savvy Dentist Facebook group up and running. It's where we do tools and training and free tips and all those sorts of things there for dentists there. It is a dentist-only group. It's a free group. And we'd love to see you in there. So all you need to do to come and join us is head across to drjessegreen.com/Facebook and you can come and join us. It's great. And we'd love to see you on the inside there, of course. But without any further ado, here is one of the smartest business people I know, Glenn Carlson. Glenn Carlson, welcome back to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It's great to have you here for round two, mate. How's things with you?
Stoked to be here, mate. Thanks for having me. Things are good. A bit chilly here in Bondi, not the thing to say on a podcast, I know, because of the whole evergreen concept, but winter's coming.
Yep, it is indeed, mate, but Bondi, if you're going to be doing winter, Bondi is the place to do winter, I can tell you that for sure.
I agree. Well, actually, I tell you what, I'm heading up to Cairns for 5 days with Anthony Robbins at his Date with Destiny program. Never done it before, very excited, so I'm going to get my rah-rah on.
Okay, that's going to be cool, mate. You'll get your rah-rah on and you'll get a bit of warmth.
Bit of warmth.
Yeah, that'll be epic.
Double whammy.
Yeah. We often have conversations when we catch up and often those conversations tend to lead down a path of scalability. So I thought what I'd really like to talk about today is that concept of scalability and kind of just hit record on some of the conversations we might have had around the traps because every time we have a convo, there's always something that good that comes out and I think, damn, I wish I'd recorded that. So,
yeah, cool.
So now's the day. Glenn, I wanted to ask you a little bit about, you speak with tons and tons and tons of small businesses, medium businesses, large businesses, and I wanted to talk specifically around the concept of scaling and making that leap to something that's more leveraged, more scalable, and getting out of that day-to-day delivery of operations. But before we kind of get into that, why is it that you think that most businesses kind of get stuck in small? And is that a bad thing or is it just a thing?
I think it's a bad thing if it's causing stress, frustration, and anxiety. Yeah. It's kind of like if you're stuck with a shitty car that's always braking, that's not a good thing if you need to be able to get from point A to point B. So I think the problem with being too small is the machine doesn't work right. The business doesn't work right. It's not profitable. You're having to do too many things to fix the thing yourself. You're not getting from point A to point B. It's not giving you what you want, etc. If that's the case, it's a problem. If you've got a great business that's spitting out good cash, putting the kids to school, you're going on holidays, you're having fun, it's not causing stress, frustration, anxiety, then you really want to ask the question, why do you need to grow it? growth for the sake of growth is cancer, literally. I'm big on the idea of building a great business that delivers your lifestyle goals first, and then if there's really something wrong with you, decide to grow wealth. So I think it's very achievable for traditional business owners and traditional businesses that have built a business around a skill set to be able to get to a great lifestyle business, 1 to 3 million in revenue, great profits, great consistency, great stability, great flexibility, great lifestyle. That's within the realm of most people if they're willing to do the work and invest in the right tools and the right advice and all that sort of stuff. People tend to not get there through trial and error, which would be kind of like me trying to fit my own braces or do my own fillings. It doesn't make sense for me to make that up on my own. I go to a professional. So that's quite achievable to grow. But that doesn't create true wealth, right? The way that will create true wealth is if you take the cash flow that your business is producing and put it into property or shares or some other wealth creation asset, because really until such time as you've got a business that's doing stably, consistently about 2 million a year in profit without being reliant on the founder. And until such time as you get to that, you're not going to be able to sell the business for any kind of life-changing amount of money. In which case, don't think of it as a balance sheet play. Don't think of it as a thing to exit. Think of it as a vehicle for cash and lifestyle. And if you want to build lasting wealth, think of some other asset classes to use that as a tool for. And I think when business owners get their head around that and go, oh, sweet, so my business is a cash machine, and I just need to create a cash machine that doesn't rely so much on me or that works more effectively, and they get their priorities straight, I guess they can focus a lot more. So no, small's not bad. Small's great, so long as it's great.
Yeah, cool. Now, just on that, mate, you mentioned most people could build a business somewhere up to $3 million if they do the work and roll their sleeves up. There'll be people listening to this podcast going, great, that sounds awesome. I'm currently at 500K. How do I get to that $3 million? So then I'm at the fork in the road of, to use your words, if there's something wrong with me and I want to go beyond that.
Yeah.
So getting to that first $3 million, mate. So tell me a little bit about your thoughts and experience observing others on that journey.
Well, and myself, right? So the first thing I think that is the most profound idea that you need to adopt if you want to sort this out is the recognition that influence flows from assets, right? What do I mean by an asset? Well, unlike the way your accountant may explain it, the way we see an asset is anything that would continue to produce new value if you and your team were to disappear, right? So if you've got a fancy website that doesn't generate any leads or any bookings, doesn't matter how much money you've spent on that, it's not an asset. If you spent no money on a Facebook page and you're getting a whole bunch of inquiries through the messenger chat, well, then that would be what we would call an asset, because if you and your team disappeared, you're still getting those inquiries. So once you start seeing your business, see, we don't tend to see our businesses as an asset. We don't see it like we see a property. If you see a property with 5 bedrooms, like, and the kitchen and all that kind of stuff, and it's a bit dilapidated, you're not going to sit there and go, oh, we need to do more sales and marketing.
No.
Right? Whereas that's what business owners tend to do. If they've got a business that's not yielding them what they want, they think, I've got to do more sales and marketing. I need more clients. Whereas we try and look at business more like you would look at a property. Whereas if you saw a property with run down rooms, well, you're going to go, oh, we need to renovate the rooms. We need to improve the asset. Improve the asset and your revenue is going to go up. You're going to get more rent. You're going to get more opportunity for an equity sale down the line potentially. So the first thing to recognize is if your business is simply an amalgamation of assets, you've got sales assets, marketing assets, operational assets, delivery assets, HR assets, finance, all these different asset categories, the phrase that rings in my mind that I apply every single day and my team apply every single day is any stress, frustration, or bottleneck that you're experiencing in your business can be traced back to an asset deficiency. Anything, right? So if we break it down really simply for the interests of a quick conversation like this, for getting to that lifestyle stage, there tends to be two big missing categories of assets. Assets that help you get known and attract new business, right? Now, again, that then means that you're getting known and attracting new business in a way that's consistent and reliable if you and your team were to disappear. So that requires you to essentially productize the sales and marketing process. And we can talk about that. the next thing to do, so you got the other side as well. The other side is to create assets that deliver remarkable value to the customer. So there's sales and marketing, and then there's the delivery and the operation side of things. Typically, the issue people have is that they tend to put more money into creating systems inside their business, but they don't have enough lead flow or sales flow to be able to compensate, or they hire a new team, but they can't really afford that team yet because they don't have the deal flow or the leads flow, etc. And so they end up paying, you know, their team more money than they're paying them, or the business simply becomes not profitable. And so to kind of make that jump from, say, 500,000 to 1.5 million, it's about investing some time, money, and focus into building out those assets in both of those sides, the sales and marketing assets that attract high quality pre-sold leads, and then assets that help you deliver great value as well.
Mate, I just wanted to pick up that comment you made earlier that any deficiency, bottleneck, headache, frustration essentially comes back to a deficiency.
An asset deficiency.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I have plagiarized that to an extent, and with credit to you, of course, but that for me has been the single biggest game changer in my own business, is to really focus on those assets. And I remember hearing you say that for the first time, and it wasn't a penny dropping. It was a penny going thud. It was just like, oh my God, okay, it's all about creation of assets. How do I create those assets?
I do quite a lot of our Facebook, by the way, mate, is going crazy. My Facebook, and if anyone wants to check it out, it's just Glenn Carlson Facebook. I do a couple of videos a week, and we're having 2,000 or 3,000 hours of people watching our stuff a week. Like, it's
wowzers.
Mental. Like wowzers. But anyway, I did a video on everyone's got a to-do list, right? But if you just keep building out a to-do list, you'll become a business operator, which means you've got to show up and operate the business.
Complete. And you want to be an owner.
You want to be a business owner, which means you need a to-build list as well. So I say, if you've got a to-do list, add another column, which becomes your to-build list, and what are the assets that you actually need to build out. And if you don't have anything on your to-build list, that's the problem.
Yeah.
Or if you don't know what to put on your to-do list, well, that's the problem. Get yourself in an environment where you're going to learn what you need to actually build out to solve the stresses, frustrations, and bottlenecks. Because if you don't have assets solving the problem, the only person or thing left to solve the problem is a person, and either it's going to be you or it's going to be one of your team. And human labor is one of the most expensive things we can throw at a problem, and it's never ending. So you become a doer or you become a builder. And the third column, which is the column you've got to build out to become an entrepreneur, is the to stop list.
Yeah, that is epically important.
What's the low value stuff that you're going to delegate and get away? So three types of lists: to-do lists, you got to have them. To build lists, that's the one to really focus on. And ultimately, if you want to become the true entrepreneur, you need a to stop list as well. And you'll stop doing admin, you'll stop doing operations, you'll stop doing sales, you'll stop doing delivery, you'll stop doing management, and eventually you'll stop running the business. And, you know, that's your Richard Branson's, where he's stopped essentially running businesses, and he's purely at that strategic level, despite the fact that he's got lots of them.
Yeah, he's got hundreds of them. Interestingly enough, mate, I had the good fortune to head across to Necker last year, and one of the profound little things that came up that I really resonated with is three-letter word was the who, not how. Same three letters, very different question, very different outcome. And of course, in the context of, you know, human labor being the most expensive, really, I think that the how part is probably, we get a little bit caught up in the sense that when we think how, we're thinking, oh, it's got to be me. But I think what you're saying is the how really is the asset. And I think that's the key point, is that, you know, Richard Branson might say who, not how, but he's built the how as an asset, not as a how.
He's asking who can help me build the asset.
Yeah, completely.
Instead of him building the asset. And so this becomes the owner's dilemma, right? The owner-builder dilemma is that because we're small businesses, we think that we've got limited resources and we need to do everything ourselves, but that actually makes the whole thing less valuable and less effective. Like if you were looking to buy a house and you came and looked at my house and you're like, wow, this is a beautiful house. It's amazing. It's exactly what I was looking for. And I say, oh, thank you, I made it myself. You'd kind of stop and you'd look at me and go, well, what do you, back up a bit. What do you mean you made it yourself? Oh, I laid the foundation. I did the brickwork. I did the grout. I did the plumbing. I did the electrical. I did the, oh, are you a plumber? Oh, no, but it's amazing what you can learn on Facebook these days,
yeah.
Right? Which is pretty much how most people are building their business. They're watching a Facebook video or they're reading a book and they're like, oh, okay, now I'm an owner builder. And the question is, what would happen to your perception of the value of my property if I'd built it myself? Well, it drops, right? Whereas if I told you, oh yeah, absolutely, we developed that room, or we had this architect who built, you know, the Sydney Opera House, and we had this person who is the top lighting designer for Vivid do all the lighting work outside, and we had, you know, Jamie Durie come and do the landscaping, and, you know, all of a sudden, same house, you've now got a much higher perception of the value because of the quality of the suppliers that you used. And so there's this kind of, sometimes there's this, it's better to buy the solution rather than to try and cobble it together in-house. And I think the beauty for small businesses going from that sort of 500 to 1.5 million is most of the assets that need to be built are based on the intellectual property that's just laying around. And so it's a very cheap build, I suppose. There aren't many areas you can get a 10x return on investment in your business. However, really building out some of this thought leadership content, some of this intellectual property stuff, certainly in the sales and marketing assets, things like blogs, articles, books, things of that nature, can very easily generate a 10x return. You get a 10x return on the sales marketing side of things, and that's often all the momentum that a business needs to just click from half a million to 1.5, because you've got all the fundamentals in place. I mean, if dentists are listening to this, you and your team know how to clean people's teeth and do the work. It's just about turning a few things up.
Yeah, completely. Mate, I wanted just to change gear for a little second, because Dent as a business is regarded, you know, through the KPI program, the Key Person of Influence program, is regarded as one of, if not the leading business accelerator, not just in Australia, but certainly around the world. One of the things I want to ask you about your own business experience in growing Dent, because it's been, you know, it's a fast growth company. It was featured in the BRW as such. And one of the things I wanted to ask you is, because I kind of look at my business as a school sometimes, and I think, what is it trying to teach me sometimes, right? And sometimes it's, the lessons are easy to get, and sometimes I have to learn it a few times. I'm wondering, in your own business experience, what do you think have been the key lessons you've learned over the last 12 to 18 months in your business journey, and how would that relate to our audience here?
The key lessons that I've learned, probably the number one lesson I've learned, is to hire really, really, really fucking slow, right? Like, really slowing down that process. I used to basically hire anyone that could say the word dent and fog a mirror. That was enough.
You got a pulse, you qualify.
Well, because my problem is I'm the optimist, right? I'm seeing a guy with no arms and no legs going, yeah, you could be a typist. Like, that's, yeah, you'll be able to do it. Like, it'll be great. And like, I try and see the best in people, and I try and shoehorn them into something, because that's what I'm good at. Like, what I'm good at in our actual business is helping people see their full potential, helping our clients see the full potential of what they could do. Doesn't mean they will do it, because, you know, it requires you to lean in. So my problem is, my greatest strength when applied to HR becomes a great weakness. So that was a big, big lesson learned. And that was learned a few years ago, but it caused all sorts of headaches. And so now we have a very rigorous, quantified approach to recruitment that absolutely codifies the first 3 months of the even trying to find the right candidate, and then the first 3 months of onboarding it. It is a machine, and it requires no subjectivity. And if I could go back in time and whisper in my ear and say, it is worth the pain of slowing down the recruitment process, it is worth the pain of building out the assets on the recruitment process first, I think I would have an extra 5 million in profit.
Oh, wow.
Over the last sort of 5 years, I'd say. Yeah.
Wow, that's a big amount of money, mate.
Oh, it's, well, because it just compounds, right? The, like, having the wrong people in the team compounds against other people on the team, et cetera, et cetera. So this asset concept doesn't just apply to sales, marketing, and delivery. You want to look at your culture assets. You want to have a look at your team assets. It can all be traced back to an asset deficiency, because now what allows us to attract incredible team that are the perfect people for the role, that are motivated, lit up, inspired, problem solvers, et cetera, it's all asset driven, right? We've actually built the infrastructure that has removed me and others from the process, and it's a very sort of quantified approach. And so, mate, I'd say that would be one big lesson. The next big lesson that I think I could go back and whisper in my ear, which is just it's okay to not feel confident.
Yeah.
Right. I rarely feel confident. I am a confident guy. People would look at me and go, that's a confident dude. Watch my videos, listen to my podcast. You wouldn't imagine it. But every day, at least every week, I've got the bit of the imposter monster. I've got this, I've got that. I remember talking to a mentor of mine. He'd built $3 billion businesses, and I was having a glass of wine with him, and he said he was nervous about his next business because, you know, there was the expectation set that it was going straight to a billion. And, you know, it just made me really recognize that uncertainty in ourselves doesn't go anywhere. You know, there is no amount of money you can make. There is no award you can win. There's no pretty girl you can marry that's going to make those inner doubts go away. I mean, it took me 3 years to launch my podcast because I thought, you know, Tim Ferriss has already got his podcast out there. The world needs another business podcast like it needs a hole in the head.
But they need to hear from you, right? That's the thing.
Well, what's crazy is like a few weeks ago, I actually got a Facebook message from someone listening to the Den podcast saying, this is so great. I used to listen to Tim Ferriss and watch Tim Ferriss's podcasts and Gary Vaynerchuk's videos. Now I've switched to your podcasts and your videos, and they're just so refreshing. Thank you.
Isn't that lovely?
And it's like, wow, really lovely.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's just like, huh, wow. And so, yeah, I guess there might be some people listening that there is that doubt, there is that, the fears, the doubts, the insecurities, the quiet little imposter monster. And all I'd say is, unfortunately, in my experience as human beings, that's the cross we bear. We can't shirk that. There's no way around it. So it's kind of like you got to feel the discomfort of that and just do shit anyway.
Yeah. How do you manage that though, mate? Because for some people, they feel that discomfort and that stops them, right? And they go, oh, that's just too much. But for me, it's one thing to say, feel the fear and do it anyway. And, you know, I know that you do feel the fear and do it anyway. But for other people, that can be something they've really got to work on and manage. So for those people who might be thinking, I need something practical to hang on to here, what sort of things do you do to manage self-doubt, mate? Because you're right, we all have it.
Yeah. So I'm pretty convinced, I'm an 80-20 rule guy, right? I'm pretty convinced that the moment someone truly recognizes that it's normal, right? But it is just like a monkey brain response trying to keep them safe, but it's not necessarily rational. It's not built around performance. If someone has, see, I think the reason that they let fear or doubt, insecurity stop them is because they're not fully conscious of the fear, the doubt, the insecurity, right? They're kind of unconsciously reacting to an emotion that's making them feel like they need to protect themselves and stay safe, right? Whereas I think if they were to objectively just look at it and go, oh, okay, like, building my business or, you know, writing a book or, you know, whatever the case may be and becoming that thought leader in the industry, right? Really making a stand for your product or your service means you're kind of got to put yourself out there a bit, which is the role of a key person of influence. It is the role of a business leader to be the vision, the values and the value proposition. And someone might go, oh, that's a bit scary. I'll just keep my head in someone's mouth, right? Well, in that case, that's where you'll stay, right? But the moment you sit there and go, actually, it's my fear of doing that and being rejected or having a dentist down the road ridicule me or, you know, point his finger at me like when I peed my pants at school and that was really embarrassing when I was in grade one and I don't want to be that kid again that everybody's laughing at. The moment that you recognize and go, oh, wow, that's where all that emotion's coming from, I think the moment you recognize it, it gives you the opportunity to move through it. I don't have any mega fancy – I mean, I'm going to Anthony Robbins because I like – the personal development journey. And I think if you have real awareness of a fear, you have awareness that it's not rational and it's just an ancient part of your brain trying to protect you from being kicked out of an imaginary group of people, and you still can't act, you know, someone like an Anthony Robbins or, you know, something like that would be potentially useful. I don't have a lot of advice for people that can, you know, if they get to that level of awareness and still can't do much about it, that's probably a deeper problem than that I can help with. Yeah. But my experience is most people, once they have recognition, tend to be able to move on and get on with it.
The vast majority, yeah, exactly. And I think you're absolutely right, mate, because, you know, it's just about noticing your thoughts and not being caught up in them and kind of go, oh, hang on, this old pattern's playing again. I remember this. This is my old friend who comes back every time I'm about to do something new.
The other thing that I would say on that, though, is, and this has become a philosophy that I live my life by, and we've built an entire business and value proposition around it, is environment dictates performance. If you show up on a regular basis to a community of like-minded business owners like our community at Dent or your community, where they are the movers, the shakers, the innovators, the TED talkers, the speakers, the authors, you name it, and they're business owners that have grown from a couple of hundred grand to a couple of million and they've been through that journey, if you're showing up in that environment on a regular basis, all of a sudden, your fears, doubts, and insecurities are the same as everybody else's fears, doubts, and insecurities. And if you put yourself in an environment where people are just getting on with it and getting shit done anyway, you will too. Because all of a sudden, that becomes the normal thing for the tribe to do. All of a sudden, if you're not being the vision, the values, and the value proposition leading from the front of your business, then you're the odd one out. Then you get kicked out of the tribe. You don't want to do that. And so you start to, you know, adopt some of the success behaviors of a new group. So, you know, sometimes it can just be, you know, if you're hanging out with a bunch of peers that are stuck in an old way of thinking, then it's highly unlikely you're going to break out of that old way of thinking. I think it was Jim Rohn, you know, you become the five people you surround yourself with. So changing your environment, changing your community, changing your accountability is a big factor that I think people like to work with the Key Person of Influence Accelerator, because it immerses them in a whole new environment for 12 months where they build relationships and friendships and community and camaraderie above and beyond the training and the structure and the strategy that we have around that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the things around that sense of community as well is, in the dental world, at least, so for people listening, you'll be aware that, yes, there are some real things going on in the marketplace. There is competition. There are changing economic circumstances. But the thing that drives me to despair is people getting caught up in that and not seeing the incredible opportunity that surrounds us every single day. It's like we're swimming in this ocean of opportunity and we're focusing on the one spiky bit of coral in front of us, and we kind of get preoccupied with the crap and forget that we're immersed in opportunity every single day. So I think, you know, you're right. Environment does dictate performance. And for anyone listening who feels like they're stuck, change it up. Find a new team, new gang, whatever. But just put yourself in a space where people are going to stretch and grow, and you can too. Mate, I wanted to talk a little bit about the insanity of building a performance business, because you guys rock this. You guys are epically good at not just doing it yourselves, but also helping other people do it. I wanted to just, before we kind of go into the mechanics of how that changes from a lifestyle business to a performance business, can you just tell us your definition of a performance business so that people can get a sense of, you know, lifestyle business up to 3 million, beyond that, tell me a bit about the characteristics of a performance business.
So we crunched the numbers, 35,000 business survey submissions, probably one of the largest entrepreneurial research projects on the planet. And we wanted to crunch the numbers and break down and kind of quantify the success factors of growth. So the five key assets to get into a lifestyle business, which is again between, well, it's actually between about 500,000 and 3 million revenue. However, it also needs to have more than 250,000 revenue per full-time employee, right? Which I think most dentists would.
That'd be doable. Easy.
Right? However, if they remove themselves from the one working on the person in the chair, it might not stay so high, right? So I would encourage dentists to work their metric on revenue divided by full-time employees with them out of the game, as though their job is to be chairman almost, and then they'll get a more realistic, because their income would most likely be skewing the numbers way out because of their deployment of time. So anyway, five assets to build out with that are pitching assets, publish assets, product assets, profile assets, partnership assets, five categories. And that's essentially what the Key Person of Influence program and the book and all that kind of stuff does. To answer your question around performance business, and by the way, my business partner just wrote the book called 24 Assets. So if someone wants to Google 24 Assets, there's a whole book on the 24 different asset classes you need to build out to build a performance business based on crunching the data. we've identified that there's a big gap called the desert between 3 million revenue and 15 million revenue. So anything in that we would call you're in the desert, you're neither a lifestyle or a performance business. It's like there's entrepreneurship and there's entrepreneur shit. and this desert is definitely that. And then sort of 15 million plus is what we would call a performance business if you're generating more than 300,000 revenue per employee. And so the issue is this desert. The issue is how do you get from 3 million to 15 million, which means you've got to double and double again. And typically a performance business is completely unrecognizable to the business that it once was. Totally different systems, totally different culture, totally different team, right? Often the team you start out with are this band of brothers coming together, making it happen, catching up, doing team meetings in cafes and a real sort of dynamic, unstructured way. And then as you start to grow, requires operational efficiency, governance. You start dealing with legal issues, HR issues, consistency issues. And all of a sudden, you've got to hire some adults that come and bring some order to this chaos. And, you know, the crew at the start don't like that new management structure coming in. The new management that have come in don't like having to deal with all these freaking kids that just want to run around like it's... What's that movie where they're like all running around like crazy kids on an island?
Oh, like Lord of the Flies.
Oh, Lord of the Flies. That's... Thank you. Right? Mental blank at a critical moment, right? So the adults don't like coming in like trying to organize a Lord of the Flies kind of small business. So there's this really awkward gap called the desert where you're not a big business, you're not a small business. It's hard to attract debt, it's hard to attract capital, it's hard to attract team, it's hard to retain team. It's now taken you, the founder, outside of your skill set. So a lifestyle business usually built around the skill set of a founder, and it is primarily focused on delivering great value to customers, right? And that's usually what the founder is always looking at ways to be able to improve the way they add value to customers. As a business starts to cross the desert, the business owner's focus tends to shift away from the customer to just trying to keep the freaking machine working. So it becomes the organizational and operational complexities that become the problem. So then you take all this focus away from the actual thing that creates value to this monster that's just consuming value. And it's a freaking pain in the ass, and it's complicated, and it's difficult, and it's challenging, which is why the percentage of businesses that get across the desert, I think businesses that are doing more than 15 million revenue in Australia and are profitable is something less than 0.01%. Like it's a minute fraction, and that's including all the corporates. So the way our kind of philosophy approaches it is get yourself up to the point where you're doing, you know, you're in spitting distance of 3 million in revenue with 250 pushing on 300,000 revenue per full-time employee, assuming you've normalized you as the founder as not being a primary income generator or deliverer, and build out the assets to stabilize there for a while. Prove that to yourself. Take 6 months off and come back and see that the business is just as profitable, just as successful without you, right? If you can't do that, you got to ask the question, what are you really scaling?
Yeah, scaling crap.
Yeah, right? You're just scaling inefficiencies. You're scaling headaches. You're scaling problems. And the numbers just get bigger. And so what happens is business just gets way more stressful because you've got way more to lose. You've got more mouths to feed. And if you're anything like me, you don't want to ever have to let people go. And that's a horrible feeling. So your fixed costs go all the way up. Like there's nothing good about scaling unless you're really freaking confident you've got something that's going to take you from a phenomenal lifestyle business to a phenomenal performance business. Having a goal of I want to build a $5 or $7 million business is crazy town. It's like saying I want my dream house in the middle of the Nullarbor. It's like it's spoken by someone that's never fucking been there, yeah. Right? Go and spend a couple of nights in the middle of a Nullarbor in a tent and then decide if you actually want to set up camp there. Go talk to some business owners that are generating $5 million a year in revenue and ask them what that's really like.
And I think that's the thing, isn't it? Because it comes back to your point earlier, Glenn, which was what are you optimizing your business for? What is it that you want from your business? And if you can achieve that in the lifestyle business, then build a bloody lifestyle business.
100%. And for most people, they can achieve that in a lifestyle business over 10 years. right? Like all the wealth that you want to create out of a performance business, you could create out of a highly profitable lifestyle business over 10 years, just managing the money, investing the money wisely. If you've got the desire to be a Richard Branson, go for it. But just understand it's a full-time game.
Yeah, well, it's really funny, mate. Just, and I'll come to actually how to cross that desert in a second. But just to come back to a conversation we had off air, I was just interviewed on a podcast and they were asking me about my own practice. And these guys run large, big practices, big numbers. And it was really interesting because I was talking about some of the profitability metrics that I care about. And it came to mind that there's so much vanity around the top line number.
Yeah, revenue.
Your revenue, right? Everyone's kind of like, pardon my language, it's a pissing contest about who's got the biggest number. And what really occurred to me is as these guys are kind of getting a little, I don't know, disparaging, I felt, about my smaller practice than theirs, it occurred to me like my practice, yes, it's small, but it's every bit as profitable and it's working just fine. Thanks very much. So, you know, I think for people listening to this podcast, there is such an emphasis on growth and growth and growth. And coming back to Glenn's comment earlier, growth for growth's sake is cancer. So you've got to ask yourself, what do you want from your practice and how do you get that rather than just constantly and relentlessly pursuing growth?
I love learning from my clients, right? So I now have a situation set up where, because I could also just keep filling my diary with work, like I can. It's just who I am. It's how I've been built. So now my PA just schedules a week off every month, no matter what. I've got a week off that's scheduled every single month. That's just empty space in the diary, right? And I force the business to work in the times outside of that. Another CEO client of mine, Ronsley, who you know, runs an audio production company called Amplify. His whole goal was to have a flip work week. He works 2 days a week and he has the rest off. So he does about $1.5 million in revenue, right? So it's a small business from a vanity perspective. However, he's got a flip fucking work week. So, you know, it's hard to argue. You might be able to say, oh, I would do $5 million a year, $10 million a year, and I'm working 6 days a week and I don't see my kids. And I'm essentially, that's my addiction is the work. And Ronsley's sitting there chilling, spending time with his family, and he's living the dream, helping his clients do the same from leveraging audio. Yeah, I think you're right, mate. And I think the ultimate vanity is time. I mean, that's the we can if we spend money, we can make more. We spend our time, we can never get it back. So I think the ultimate vanity metric is how much disposable time do you have with enough cash to be able to do with that time what you want.
Yeah, mate, I reckon that is key. Absolutely key. So for anyone listening, that is the metric you want to be focusing on is time. Time is the currency that really matters. I wanted to just quickly talk about what it would be, though, if someone said, you know, I'm at $3 million, I'm stable, and I'm Indiana Jones. I want to give it a crack.
So, well, the first thing that I'd recommend is read this book, 24 Assets. We essentially break down 24 different categories of assets from everything from your underlying intellectual property to your brand, to your market assets. So what are the assets that help you attract the ideal target market? Things like positioning, channels, data, right? Data is going to be a key driver in growth. Product assets is another category, whether that be, and you want to have product assets, at least 4 to 5 different categories of product assets. So one category of product assets are specifically and simply designed to capture the attention of your audience, of a dormant market. The second is designed to build trust, diagnose a problem and collect data. So we've got our like digital data scorecards. People can go to keypersonofinfluence.com/scorecard and actually benchmark themselves and their ability to influence against those 5 areas. So we encourage our clients to build similar scorecards. If you go to inspire.business, a couple of accountant buddies of ours have built a similar diagnostic scorecard to be able to help you identify where the profit's going in your business. So essentially, we've got a layer of products to capture attention. We've got a layer of products that diagnose problems and collect data. Then we've got to have the productized service offering, and then we've got to have a recurring revenue product. And then potentially there's a product for industry where you license, repackage, resell to to industry. So that's the product layer of 24 Assets. Then there's culture assets. So how to attract and retain top team at a discount. There's a reason people want to work for Google and work for Virgin and work for all these cool brands, and it's because of the culture, the cultural infrastructure they have in place. Systems assets are assets that run the business without you and remove humans and human error from the process, and then ultimately funding assets, which create liquidity in the business. So how to attract debt or how to attract capital for a good return. So the first thing that we would recommend someone do is they get really freaking clear on what do the 24 categories of assets need to look like in their business to have a $15 million a year business. So what does their IP need to look like? What does their brand need to look like? What does their culture need to look like? What does their product ecosystem need to look like? What does their funding structure, their shareholding agreements, et cetera, need to look like? What does their systems infrastructure need to look like at the end game? And then what we do when we're working with clients to do this is we reverse engineer a three-year game plan and innovation schedule to build that out. So, you know, essentially just those layers again: IP assets, brand assets, market assets, product assets, systems assets, culture assets, and funding assets. You need to know what your business is going to look like at 15 million plus in all those categories and the subcategories you can find in the book. You can also just do our heat map on 24 assets. So if you do have a multi-million dollar business, just go to 24assets.com and you'll be able to get the book and do the heat map, which will benchmark whether you're strong or weak in each of those asset categories. Then the game is that balancing act between investing cash in building out those assets and
keeping cash for operations
and not running out of money.
Yeah, exactly.
So this was the mistake we made, right? We made the mistake 5 years ago once we came across this concept of influence follows assets, and we just started spending all our money on developing assets, not recognizing or in our youthful exuberance paying enough attention to how much time was required to be able to get the operational yield on those and not run out of cash. So we had our own cash challenges, but you know, you move through these things and that's part of the challenge of crossing the desert. But forewarned is forearmed. If you were going to quite literally cross a desert, you'd pause in the city, you'd stock up on all the resources you need, you knew what it was going to look like, how long it was going to take, what you'd need, etc.
Yeah, contingencies and so on.
All that, and then you'd go. The other beauty of starting to develop those 24 asset categories is as you cross the desert, you need to be shifting your thinking from P&L, sales and marketing, to balance sheet and equity, right? Because that's where the real value comes in. And the way we crossed the desert quickly was through acquisition, because we built our earnings multiple to 9x, which means we were able to acquire complementary business services that were trading at a multiple of 2x. So without significant dilution to the majority shareholders, which is Dan and I, we were able to acquire three businesses quite rapidly, which rapidly helped us achieve that kind of scale that we needed. So it comes back to this concept of buy, don't build. But instead of just buying the internal assets, you get to the level where you can actually start buying the businesses. But it's the same paradigm. Instead of us building in-house IT capacity to help our clients build out digital platforms and digital scorecards, etc., we acquire the business. All sorts of things become possible. So flipping that from a dentist perspective, if I was a dentist, yeah, I'd go, how do I build the ultimate branding, positioning, marketing, onboarding system of a practice? How do I position that as the one to beat? And then I would either look at, do I license that strategy, or do I use the value of the business I've built to just acquire other businesses?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a fundamental thing that, you know, we certainly do. And all the assets that we've built for our program that we teach is essentially everything we've built in our own practice. So it's about leveraging those assets as well. So love that, mate. Hey, listen, mate, really quickly, I know that you've got a meeting to get to and I don't want to hold you up for that, but I just want to come back to the first episode we recorded with you. And you came up with, I asked you at the time, people who had inspired you. And one of the people who inspired you was your dad. And you shared a saying, which was, sail the wind you've got.
Sell the weather you've got, yeah.
Yeah, right. And so, yeah, that's a saying that has resonated with lots of people in our audience. You know, kind of deal with what you got and get on with it. I wondered, as we wrap up our episode today, because it's been really insightful to talk about the lifestyle business and really why you might want to stay at the lifestyle business. But for those small percentage who do want to cross the desert and have a go, you've got a roadmap there laid out. But as we kind of wrap up our conversation today, we've spoken a lot about assets. We've spoken a lot about measures for success, you know, time being the ultimate metric and all those sorts of things. I wondered, from your perspective, what have been other key influences in your life that have helped you get to where you are? Because I've known you now for probably 6 years, I think, and certainly as an outsider observing your journey, it's been, yeah, rapid. So I'm curious to understand, beyond your dad and sail the weather you've got, what other influences have helped you get to where you are?
So it's so funny because the big influence that I have, I want to come back to my dad. He's got another great little aphorism that he says, but I'm trying to...
Go for it.
Look, I tell you what. Well, I'll give you a couple, right? There was this one time I was on the boat with dad this is a few years ago, floating around the Philippines. And dad's always been a bit of a workaholic, ex-Navy boy, and he's up the mast fixing a weather vane or something. And I'm down with a couple of friends of mine. We're enjoying a bit of a drink. And I'm like, Dad... Like, give it a rest, mate. Come down, have a drink, enjoy yourself. And he leans over out of the bosun's chair. He's right at the top of the mast, sweat dripping off him, and he's cursing, he's yelling, and he calls back down, I am enjoying myself.
Okay. Right?
And over a drink that night, you know, we were just kind of philosophizing on the idea that you just got to pick the problems you love to solve in the world.
Yeah, nice.
You know? And dad's chosen, he loves to solve the problems of trying to keep boats afloat, you know, and that's his love. But that really resonated for me because I think some people find themselves in business and they just hate, you know, having to solve the problems of sales and marketing and delivery and customers and people, in which case, like, get out of business, like, do something else or find a business where you actually enjoy solving the problems because they're not going to go anywhere. Like, my company doesn't help people get to a point where they got no problems in their business. They just get to the point where they can solve more meaningful problems in their business. Another huge influencer, like, totally changed my life was Steve Jobs when I watched his Stanford commencement speech, where he basically said, if I'm looking myself in the mirror too many days in a row, not liking what I'm doing today, I changed something. And when I watched that, I'd been in London for 2 years. I was pale. I was depressed. I was not enjoying that kind of city life at all. I mean, I'm a surfer. I'm a volunteer at the Bondi Surf Club. Like, I'm a water boy, right? And I was not in a good space. And I watched that video, and it was like Jobs himself just reached out, placed his hand on my heart, and said, go. And that helped give me the courage because if Steve Jobs could look at his life and have weeks and months where he wasn't happy, then it was okay for me too. And so that was a profound shift. And I've always just admired Branson's ability to have fun and be wacky and just do whatever the hell he wants, really. So I've always been just more inspired by a distance from that dude rather than anything in particular. But yeah, those would be, you know, if I was to think of the people that really inspire me, it comes back to my dad. And the Bransons and the Musks and the Jobses. Yeah. I like those dudes.
Yeah, they're pretty cool dudes. Hey, mate, speaking of cool dudes, I'm going to put you in that category as well. I really appreciate you coming to hang with us today, mate. It's been a really fun conversation, as always. And it's nice that we got to hit record on this one because there's so many times I've walked away going, oh, damn, I wish I had a recorder for that. That was just a gem. So, mate, from all of us here at the show, I want to say thank you for taking the time out of your day to come and hang with us. Really appreciate not just the time but the insights, the wisdoms and the lesson that you share with us because it really does accelerate our journey on our business path. So from all of us here, mate, thank you. You're a gem.
Mate, thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're a good man, Charlie Brown, and I'll talk to you soon, hey?
Thanks for having me. Over and out. Thanks, guys.
Cheers, mate. Bye now.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast with Dr. Jesse Green. For more free tools and resources, join the free Facebook group. Visit drjessegreen.com/Facebook. And for more episodes, visit drjessegreen.com/Savvy Dentist.